Good afternoon. Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Woodward. All this week, Speaking in Maine features highlights of the 2016 Camden Conference. The Camden Conference was founded in 1987 as a nonprofit, nonpartisan educational organization whose mission is to foster informed discourse on world issues. The focus of the conference this year, a new Africa. Today's speaker, Ms. Jennifer Cook, is director of the CSIS Africa program, which she joined in 2000. The program provides balanced and forward-looking analysis of political and economic dynamics within African states to better inform U.S. policy choices. Ms. Cook covers a broad range of U.S.-Africa policy issues, including security engagement, health assistance, conflict diplomacy, and support for good governance. She leads the CSIS Nigeria Election Forum, co-chairs a CSIS project on Africa's new oil and gas producers and the implications of the continent's changing energy landscape for U.S.-Africa policy. Prior to CSIS, she worked at the National Academy of Sciences, in the Office of Human Rights, and the Office of News and Public Information, and at the U.S. Congress on the House Subcommittee on Africa. She has lived in the Ivory Coast and the Central African Republic. Speaking in Maine is available for streaming and podcasting on our website, mpbn.net.
I'm going to be talking about U.S. policy towards Africa. I'll take a little bit of a look back and then look at some of the dilemmas going forward as Africa changes. I think one of the themes of this conference has been how much Africa is changing, how dynamic, how diverse, how divergent in some ways. And that really poses a challenge for a unified Africa policy. So as an Africa policy analyst, I get asked all the time, well, what is US policy towards Africa? And the longer I'm in it, the harder and harder for me it is to say what exactly that is. Let's start with maybe what I would consider the three clumps of interest that the US has in Africa. And these are fairly consistent over time. First, you have pragmatic considerations of direct interest. Those are things like economic interests, you know, strategic minerals, oil, and so forth. You have security interests and counter-terrorist interests. You know, top of that list is protecting US citizens, US assets, and the US homeland. It sounds cold, but that's kind of what national interests in every country, that's kind of the number one priority. And then trade and investment, so helping America grow economically, which often depends on helping partners grow economically as well. The second set of interests is the values-based agenda. And I think this has been really what many feel is at the heart of American exceptionalism or ostensible American exceptionalism in the world. That there is a sense of generosity, a sense of wanting to do the right thing in times of crisis for people who are less fortunate. You have, for example, humanitarian assistance in times of crisis. Response to the HIV/AIDS crisis, for example, democracy promotion. I think human rights, civil liberties, and human rights and promotion of good governance and democratic governance has always been seen as an important core and pillar of US foreign policy. We can talk more about that in a bit. And then finally, the third clump is kind of the spheres of influence. America's place in the broader world in terms of leadership, in terms of shaping global governance norms, in shaping global norms on human rights, governance, things like climate change, nuclear proliferation, where you need alliances and partners in helping shape those things. Now, these things, as I say, are consistent over time, I think, as areas or collections of interests. But depending on the context within the United States, the US leader, the US public, US Congress, the private sector, depending on dynamics within Africa, things that are changing, whether it's crisis, conflict, opportunity, and things that are happening in the more global geopolitical world. Are we in a bipolar world of superpowers? Are we in a more multi-power world where the U.S. has to look a little harder to build alliances? All of those shape these various interests and what gets emphasized at a particular time. Obviously, and I think it's important to emphasize to U.S. policymakers that these things overlap in important ways. We've heard yesterday, you know, at the heart of so much of the insecurity in Africa is bad governance, repressive governments, lack of development, poverty, unemployment. And so our direct interests may, in fact, emanate from poor governance and so forth. In U.S. leadership in the global world, failure to respond to pandemics like the HIV pandemic or humanitarian crisis or the conflict and the genocide in Rwanda, those leave real marks on our U.S. leadership in the world. So these overlap in important ways, but at certain points they also come into conflict and they kind of butt up against each other. And there are multiple constituencies within the United States that ultimately shape our foreign policy, and sometimes they're working at cross purposes with one another. And what you get then is accusations sometimes of double standards or hypocritical or inconsistencies in applying our so-called values and interests. So I thought I would look a little back in time at U.S. orientation and how these three sets of interests have evolved. In the Cold War, I would say that the sphere of influence paradigm was predominant. In the 90s, that gave way to a more humanitarian, values-driven agenda when there was no more kind of global framework that U.S. policy fit into. In the 2000s, globalization of economy, of security threats, I think led to a much more a view of Africa as affecting U.S. interests much more directly. And today, I'd say that a coherent Africa policy becomes even more difficult because you have all of these various things. In a globalized world, Africa matters much more to the United States because of all the transnational connections. So interests are not only more intense, they're more complicated. And it's very hard to find the right balance among them. You know, what is Africa policy towards Africa? Nigeria versus Botswana, those are going to be two very different policies. Kenya versus Angola, Senegal versus Zimbabwe, it's very hard to have any overarching theme in that. And I think one of the critiques of the Obama administration has been, well, where's the narrative? What's your story on Africa? And the fact is, it's very hard anymore to have some overarching narrative that captures the continent that is so diverse. So let's go back a little bit, because I think it's important for U.S. policy and how effective U.S. policy is to look at some of the mistakes and some of the lessons learned from the past. I wanted to start with this. I think it's, you know, the modern maps today were done by, in the 15th century, by a Dutchman who was writing out navigation lines for Scandinavian sailors. And so a very biased map, a distorted map that really squashed Africa and Latin America down into the quadrant. It's a very good app online where you can take the modern map but actually take country sizes and move them and compare. That's the United States, China, India, most of Europe, Eastern Europe. You got UK is the size of Madagascar. Japan is in there. We sometimes fail to appreciate just how large a continent mass, and that's largely due to European-made maps. So let's move to the Cold War. For much of the post-independence period, sphere of influence, as I said, was kind of the defining characteristic. And the U.S.-Soviet ideological battle over expanding their spheres of control in the world really framed the engagement. Now, we did have direct interests at that time. There were strategic minerals in key places that we wanted access to. There was a values aspect to some of our policies. The Food for Peace program was initiated under Kennedy. You know, there's some debates on how effective that was and whether it was truly for African benefit or if it was for getting rid of some of the excess farm production here in the United States. And Jimmy Carter came in the midst of this Cold War and really for the first time introduced the notion of human rights into the US diplomatic engagement in these places. My father was a diplomat in Africa at the time, and they had a heads of mission meeting in Abidjan, and they announced that this would, it was Andrew Young came and announced that this would be kind of the new line in US policy. And you know, my father's a pretty liberal guy, but he said all these suited diplomats kind of were looking at each other, you know, that's, we don't do that. We do realpolitik. What is this nonsense about human rights? But it has endured, and that's now very much a part of how we see our foreign policy. And if I say we, I sometimes confuse me and the US government. I'm not with the US government. I just take on this empathetic, not that I always agree with them. So, but during the Cold War, overall, our partnerships with African leaders stemmed largely from their anti-communist credentials. We did not care if they were benevolent dictators even. We did not care if they were delivering services, human rights, economic benefits. It was really, we based our relationships on anti-communist credentials. So I thought we'd play Name That Cold War Partner. I was up there, but this is Sam Doe, Staff Sergeant Sam Doe from Liberia, who is known, he was important to the United States because the US had an important CIA listening post in Liberia. Sam Doe is renowned for lining up the ministers of his of the previous cabinet along the beach. There are horrific pictures and heartrending pictures of this, and shooting them all dead. He was a brutal man, not very well educated. Yet he was welcomed at the White House, where Ronald Reagan warmly greeted him as welcome Chairman Mo. So that's a little story about that. So he was important, but not that important. Next we have our favorite Mobutu Sese Seko, Congo, just because of its sheer size. The mineral wealth that it had was considered a strategic prize. U.S. had a very speckled past. I can never remember that phrase. In Zaire at the time, the assassination of the first democratically leader, Lumumba. If the CIA didn't do it directly, it certainly was, happy to see him go because he was considered too far left for our US interests. Mobutu Sese Seko was put in place. I don't know how many of you remember Mobutu. It was around him that the term kleptocracy was first coined. He received huge sums of money from the United States, huge military assistance. The World Bank lent to him like there was no tomorrow, which ultimately left Congo, when he departed, in this massive debt that it took years to kind of lift off. I just added this picture here. This is the famous Rumble in the Jungle with Muhammad Ali and George Foreman. That was a good moment in Zaire. If you ever get to, yes, Ali Boumaye, if you ever want to see a fantastic documentary that looks at Zaire in that time, that looks at Ali, and an athletic documentary that looks at developments in the United States around the civil rights movement, you have to see When We Were Kings. I just want to put that pitch out there. It's not totally related to the talk, but It gives a good sense of the times then. Next on the list of fame, Jonas Savimbi. Again, U.S. was engaged in the Civil War, or backed Savimbi against a Soviet-backed MPLA, a Chinese-backed FNLA. The Cubans came in eventually. Savimbi was feted in Washington as a freedom fighter and a hero. Two of his main prompters, actually, in Washington at that time were Grover Norquist and Jack Abramoff. Some of you may know them. Savimbi prolonged a brutal civil war. After elections had happened, he kind of reneged on his promises, went back to war. Throughout this, interestingly, the U.S. continued to extract oil from Angola, protected, ironically, by Cuban troops at the time. So. Finally, probably the worst of our U.S., and I'm probably dwelling a little too long on this, but one of the worst of our partnerships during this time was with the apartheid regime in South Africa, which was considered a strategic partner to the United States because they were vehemently anti-communist. Reagan called the South African regime the last friendly country in the region. The ANC in Washington circles, again, kind of fed by Norquist and Abramoff, became labeled a terror group. Jesse Helms and others, kind of conservatives in the Congress, decried black-on-black violence, and it was just blacks killing each other, really denying the fact that it was this brutal, institutionalized, racist regime and that was feeding that. Chet Crocker at the time, and I've come to have great respect for Chet Crocker, but Chet Crocker's remedy for this was what was called constructive engagement. We'll keep working with the apartheid government, and that way we'll maybe be able to persuade them to change their ways. I was in the Congress at the time, working as a staff member. You know, very young, Chet Crocker was just the Darth Vader of the time. I still think he was wrong on this. I think constructive engagement with a partner that already sees you as a solid partner is just not effective. It just means business as usual. This was also a moment in U.S. policy where that values agenda came back, and you had that tension between strategic interest, as the Reagan administration understood it, and values. You had burbling up, and it had been over some time, the anti-apartheid movement here in the United States, where churches, black churches, white churches, university students, activists, the Congressional Black Caucus, many other politicians began demonstrating and pushing hard to impose comprehensive sanctions against South Africa, against Crocker's constructive engagement paradigm. Eventually, a law was passed in Congress. Ronald Reagan vetoed it, didn't think it was time. Again, public pressure, Congress, even though it was Republican at the time, came back and overrode that veto, and sanctions were imposed. I think this was a moment of the values agenda at its best. I think it was one of the few times that we saw Congress at its best. It was really, it was a very exciting time to be there. You know, I go through this a bit of length because this has had lasting damage, I think, to how we engage in Africa. You know, from the colonial states, and their skewed incentives of extraction and control, we moved to a paradigm where the big superpowers rewarded countries not on their good governance, not on their service delivery, but on their credentials, ideological credentials. So the incentives for good governance were just not there. Mobutu made, you know, with tons of assistance flowed into DRC or Zaire, none of it used to the benefit of Zaire. So it undermined accountability. I think in many ways, by cutting off the democratic, natural democratic process. You know, we helped in some ways, although I don't, you know, we're not entirely responsible, but in some ways perpetuate the conflict, undercut those measures of accountability, whether it was in Liberia, whether it was in DRC, whether it was in Angola. We left DRC with a massive debt burden because the World Bank would just lend willy-nilly. And we also left some lasting resentments in Africa. And I think you heard some of it coming out yesterday. You know, conspiracy theories on, oh, who's beyond the Ebola crisis, who's beyond, you know, it's the CIA. I mean, we think those are ridiculous, but they resonate with people because there is this kind of history of subterfuge and by the United States, and, you know, those kinds of narratives stick for a long time. Lasting resentments in Angola that still has a very prickly relationship with the United States, and in South Africa. You know, I think we, as a nation, ended up on the right side of that fight in the end, and, you know, Obama was out there picketing along with the rest of us. But there still remains huge resentment in South Africa about the United States' role in supporting the regime. And other countries, the Soviets, China, Cuba, were actually working with the liberation movements, and that has given them kind of a leg up in terms of reputation with some of those countries. With the end of the Cold War, the Clinton years, you kind of didn't have this defining paradigm anymore. And really, humanitarian impulse kind of came to the fore, that values agenda. There was not real perceived any strategic interests. So humanitarian was going to be the rule of the day. The two major definers of the Clinton tenure were first Somalia and the debacle. What started out as a humanitarian intervention overreached a little bit and then ended up with 19 US servicemen being dragged through the streets of Mogadishu. That was a huge scar on the American psyche. And the idea was that the US would not be putting any more combat troops in Africa unless there was an absolute vital interest at stake. And that has remained very true until just recently. That Somali experience shaped US policy so much that when the Rwanda genocide unfolded, the US, very reluctant to get itself entangled into this humanitarian crisis, not only did not respond itself, but it also helped block a UN mission from going in to respond. You know, there may have been political considerations at stake. Susan Rice is famously quoted as saying, you know, we don't want to call it a genocide in an election year because that will put pressure on us. Susan, you know, I'm sure she regrets that deeply. And I also think it accounts for some of her ideology in terms of responding to Sudan, Libya, and other places. I think that has left its mark. And then humanitarian intervention, the problem with it is if it's not pinned to direct interests, and those direct interests understood, it can be very fickle and inconsistent. And if CNN attentions move somewhere else, you know, policymakers move somewhere else. You can try to do humanitarianism on the cheap. And I think out of the Rwanda debacle came, you know, African solutions for African problems. Like, you guys need to figure this out yourselves. UN peacekeeping is kind of the panacea for conflicts. Huge burgeoning of UN peacekeepers at that time in Africa. In the second half of the Clinton administration, you saw a more exuberant outlook. The fall of the Berlin Wall, South Africa, democracy and multipartyism breaking out in many places in Africa. So there was kind of a new excitement towards the end of his tenure. The embrace of new leaders, Isaias Afwerki in Eritrea, Meles Zenawi in Ethiopia, Yoweri Museveni in Uganda, and Laurent Kabila in DRC were considered new leaders who were really going to deliver to their people. Well, within 5 years, they were all at war with one another.
And they are all, except for Meles, who died, still in power, and Laurent Kabila, whose son carries on his legacy. So let me move to, overall, the Clinton years ended up on an up note. He traveled a lot to Africa, which really raised attention to Africa, to US constituencies. And I think that is one of his enduring legacies, that he actually raised the profile of Africa. The Bush years. Okay, that's not a... One of the things about Bush, you know, there were such low expectations of him in Africa. He actually did really important things, not without mistakes, but also I feel like he really enjoyed it. And when he came back from Africa trips, he didn't have the kind of same defensiveness or closed in that if he was talking about Iraq or other places. I think he really enjoyed being there, and he enjoyed and he was proud of his legacy. And I think with good reason, on many counts, not entirely. At that time, Africa's profile was rising. You had new constituencies in Washington. Sudan, the flight between North and South Sudan mobilized this enormous constituency that included conservative Christians, liberal black churches, who were concerned about slavery or persecution of Christians. And that moved, that built out eventually into the Save Darfur and so forth. So you had these big new constituencies building. You had, at the get-go, so a big push on Sudan was one of the first things he did out of the blocks, and a very successful negotiation to end the war. 9/11 happened early in his term. Africa suddenly took on the significance. Could this be the spillover of where bin Laden and Afghani fighters go after they have been pushed out of Afghanistan? And the fear was that they would go into the Horn of Africa, Somalia, and cause havoc there. Energy stakes. US was looking very much to diversify its interests in energy. 19% of its imports at that time came from Africa, so a new interest there as well. HIV/AIDS, at that moment, 25 million in 2000, 25 million Africans were infected with HIV. 4 million new infections in 2000 alone, and the trajectory was expected to go up like this. People were dying without recourse to treatment. I really do have to nip through this. Some of the big legacies of the Bush administration. PEPFAR, $15 billion over 5 years. That has actually continued, and President Obama has preserved that investment over time. Initially, very much focused on treatment. How do we get treatment faster to those who need? And the idea, Congress, in a bipartisan way, came behind this because of the horror of HIV, and that you would bring treatment to those affected with AIDS, and you would see what was called the Lazarus effect. You know, it was very visible, tangible impact of what US assistance was doing. President Bush launched the Millennium Challenge Corporation, which seeks to incentivize good governance by giving big grants on economic growth initiatives in a number of these countries. That remains today. And he set up the US-Africa Command, which took responsibilities that had been held in European Command, Pacific Command, and the Central Command, and put them into a new African Command that was going to do more gentle kind of combatant command work, perhaps a little too ambitious in its development democracy ambitions, quite controversial, and we can talk about that a little bit during the Q&A. Obama years. Obama came out of the blocks a little bit slow, I think. He was facing a huge deficit. He was facing two hot wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. He had a global economic crisis, a domestic crisis, a battle on healthcare, and Africa was not particularly high on his list. He made a brief trip to Ghana where he decried big men, but nothing major really in that first term. I think in his second term, he began to pick up what when, and had to, given what was happening on the continent. Insecurity, the three nodes of violent extremism and transnational crime, Al-Shabaab in Somalia, Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb and its various offshoots in the Sahel, Boko Haram in northern Nigeria, all of those called for some kind of expanded response. Right now, the great fear is that Libya, which is in so much chaos and caused overspill in previous years, now with ISIL deeply entrenched there with huge arms caches, should there be some solution in Libya, the great fear is that those people spill back over into Mali, Niger, Chad, Nigeria, much more ruthless than they were before, and much more armed. So that is a huge concern. You're talking about the trench. How is it that the US can help fortify those countries to prevent against that potential leech? Health, HIV, AIDS, those funding levels have been preserved, bipartisan support for them. The Ebola crisis response was very important, with the US military providing logistics lift. You have a new interest in economic growth, trade and investment. In part, this is due to Africa's growing economic opportunities and the growth rates. In part, I think it wasn't driven, but it certainly piqued by China's role and their success in investment, in making new inroads economically, which many Africans initially welcomed and said, look, we need roads. We'd rather have a road to market than a lecture on human rights. And the US felt, you know, we need to, A, our private sector is going to lose out on some opportunities, but B, you know, many African citizens and governments are looking for something different from us than what we've done in the past. So a big shift in the Obama administration was to move, to elevate that economic growth aspect in our and commercial engagement within it. Democracy has been a little bit more problematic. Because we do have all these other interests and security partnerships with authoritarian governments, the Obama administration has tried to reach out around governments to civil society. In many cases, that's very doable, but in a number of places, Ethiopia, Rwanda, the government has said domestic NGOs cannot receive foreign funding, and that pretty much wipes out the domestic NGO community. I think the irony is that our democracy assistance is best where there is a little bit of opening. So in a Kenya, in a Nigeria, in some of the places that are already slightly open where we can engage, but in deeply authoritarian countries like Angola, Rwanda, even Uganda, I think we're much more limited in our leverage. And those countries can look and say, you know, we don't need the US as much as we used to. We've got China over here, we've got other partners. The Washington says this doesn't make sense to us. What about the Singapore model? That's what we want to go for, which is a more authoritarian model. Some of the initiatives from Obama's term, a number of them, I think they're hitting the right areas, and they're designed to bring the private sector more fully into the mix. So Feed the Future, focused on agriculture, but trying to get private sector investment engaged in that. I think his biggest initiative legacy will be Power Africa. We talked about the obstacles to investment and growth yesterday. Infrastructure and the generation of electricity is probably the most difficult barrier in terms of manufacturing, in terms of education, health, and all kinds of things. Africa, you saw that map at the beginning. Africa produces as many gigawatts as Spain, which fits into that tiny corner up in the northeast. And we heard that yesterday, 40% lack access to energy. It's very difficult for a company to go in and invest if they have to pay exorbitant prices for diesel. Trade Africa, U.S.-Africa Summit again, that was intended to introduce a new Africa to the United States, to get the private sector more engaged, and to kind of open Americans' eyes to the opportunities in Africa. I want to talk a little bit about some of the issues with U.S. engagement in Africa, and I think these can come out in the questions as well. First, the diversity and volume of interests in Africa just guarantees that our interests are sometimes going to be in conflict with one another. The question is, how do we balance those? How do we ensure that we're not doing the short term and not thinking about the long term consequences? Intervention in Libya was good, but look what it did for the rest of Mali and the rest of the Sahel in terms of setting off violent extremism, takeover of territory, and so forth. Second, the U.S. assumption that all good things go together, democracy, economic growth, development, security, that's getting challenged. Some of our partners, Kagame in Rwanda or Melis in Ethiopia, they're actually doing pretty good economically. And they're also security partners. And that makes U.S. face some difficult conundrums on how to deal with authoritarians who are actually, in some areas, doing okay. Ultimately, I think that growth will be stymied by that authoritarian governance, but for the moment, those interests are in tension. Fourth, U.S. touts this country ownership, and we just do kind of what the countries want from us. But as was said yesterday, a lot of those decisions are made in Congress. And Congress likes children, Congress likes maternal health, Congress likes HIV/AIDS treatment, because you can see the results like that. Congress is less keen about agricultural development. It's less keen about education, because you don't really see the payoff of education for a generation. And I think that was one of the things that we have tried to push back against. Think longer term, find better benchmarks so that you can invest in these things that are much longer term. Finally, it's a much more competitive political and economic playing field out there. The U.S. is not kind of the superpower that it once was. Our man in Africa can order people around. We have to be a little bit more humble. We have to try a little bit harder to be relevant and influential there. Three areas that I would push for are agriculture and the business of agriculture, infrastructure still, and in all my travels in the Sahel, whether it's a security, whether it's an economic, whether it's a national cohesion, social compact issue, whether it's getting critical thinking going, education, to my mind, has to be key. I would like to see the same kind of investment that we put into HIV/AIDS and health systems put into the education system. And my hope is that the next president, whoever that will recognize that. That is something that, without exception, people comment. Civic education, life education, history education, as Kawa was saying yesterday, those are totally critical, I think, to bring countries together, to give a sense of common identity, a common grounding, and the skills eventually to thrive. I'll just leave it at that, and I will. So sorry.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. All this week, we are featuring highlights from the recent 2016 Camden Conference. This year's focus, A New Africa. Today's speaker was Ms. Jennifer Cook. The program is available for streaming and podcasting from our website, mpbn.net. Charles Beck is our executive producer. For Speaking in Maine and Maine Public Radio, I'm Jonathan Woodward.